Thierry the Hunter moved like a shadow. He laid his tiny feet down gently upon the great pad marks of the elephant where the bull's weight had compacted the earth, and no twig would snap and no dead leaf would rustle to betray him. Piri had been following the elephant for 3 days. During all that time, Piri's entire being had been concentrated upon the elephant, so that in some mystic way he had become part of the beast he was hunting. Where the bull had stopped to feast on the little red berries of the celepi tree, Piri read the sign and could taste the tart, acidic juice in his own throat. Where the elephant had drunk at one of the streams, Piri stood upon the bank, as he had done, and felt, in his imagination, the sweet clear water squirt and gurgle into his own belly. Where the elephant had dropped a pile of yellow fibrous dung on the forest floor, Piri felt his own bowels contract and his sphincter relax in sympathy. Piri had become the elephant, and the elephant had become Piri. When he came up with him at last, the bull was asleep on his feet in a matted thicket. The branches were interwoven and covered with thorns that were hooked and tipped with red. They could flay a man's skin from his limbs. As softly and slowly as Piri moved, yet the elephant sensed his presence and came awake. He spread his ears, one wide and full as a mainsail, the other torn and deformed, and he listened. However, he heard nothing, for Piri was a master hunter. The elephant stretched out his trunk, sucked up the air and blew it softly into his mouth. The olfactory glands in his top lip opened like pink rosebuds, and he tasted the air. But he tasted nothing, for Piri had come in below the tiny forest breeze, and he had smeared himself from the top of his curly head to the pink soles of his feet with the elephant's own dung. There was no man smell upon him. Then the elephant made a sound, a gentle rumbling sound in his belly, and a fluttering sound in his throat. It was the elephant song. The bull sang in the forest to learn if it was another elephant or a deadly enemy whose presence he sensed. Piri crouched at the edge of the thicket and listened to the elephant sing. Then he cupped his hand over his mouth and his nose, and he gulped air into his throat and his belly, and he let it out with a soft rumbling and fluttering sound. Piri sang the song of the elephant. The bull sighed in his throat and changed his song, testing the unseen presence. Faithfully, Piri replied to him, following the cadence and the timbre of the song, and the elephant bull believed him. The elephant flapped his ears, a gesture of contentment and trust. He accepted that another elephant had found him and come to join him. He moved carelessly, and the thicket crackled before his bulk. He came ambling forward to meet Piri, pushing the thorny branches aside. Piri saw the curved shafts of ivory appear high above his head. They were thicker than his waist and longer than he could reach with his elephant spear. The elephant spear was a weapon that Piri had forged himself from the blade of a truck spring that he had stolen from one of the dukas at the roadside. He had heated and beaten it until the steel had lost its temper, and he was able to work it more easily. Then Piri had shaped and sharpened it and fitted it to the shaft of a hard, resilient wood and bound the blade in place with rawhide. When the rawhide dried, it was hard and tight as the steel it held. As the elephant's head loomed above him, Piri sank down and lay like a log or a pile of dead leaves on the forest floor. The elephant was so close that he could make out clearly every furrow and wrinkle in the thick grey hide. Looking up, he could see the discharge from the glands in the elephant's head running like tears down his cheeks. And Piri gathered himself. Even with the spear he had made, which was sharp and heavy and almost twice as long as Piri was tall, he could never drive the point through the hide and meat and the cage of ribs to pierce the bull's heart or his lungs. The brain, in its bony casket, was far beyond his reach. There was only one way that a man of Piri's size could kill an enormous beast like this with a spear. Piri rolled to his feet and bounded up under the elephant's belly. He stood between the bull's back legs, and he braced himself and drove the point of the spear upwards into the angle of his groin. The elephant squealed as the blade sliced through the baggy skin that hung around his crotch and lanced up into the sack of his bladder. The razor steel split his bladder open and the hot urine sprayed out in a yellow jet. He convulsed with agony, hunching his back, before he began to run. The elephant ran screaming through the forest, and the foliage crashed and broke before him. Piri leaned on his bloody spear and listened to the elephant run out of earshot. He waited until the silence was complete, and then he girded up his loincloth and began to follow the dribbled trail of blood and urine that steamed and reeked on the forest floor. It might take many hours to die, but the elephant was doomed. Piri the hunter had struck a mortal blow, and he knew that before tomorrow's sunset, the elephant would be dead. Piri followed him slowly, but he did not feel the fierce hunter's joy in his heart. There was only a sense of emptiness and the terrible guilt of sacrilege. He had offended his god, and he knew that now his god must reject and punish him. Piri the hunter found the carcass of the elephant bull the next morning. The elephant was kneeling with his legs folded up neatly beneath him. His head was supported by the massive curves of ivory that were half buried in the soft earth. The last rainstorm had washed his hide so that it was black and shiny, and his eyes were open. He appeared so lifelike that Piri approached him with great caution, and at last reached out with a long, thin twig to touch the open, staring eye fringed with thick lashes. The eyelid did not blink to the touch, and Piri noticed the opaque, jelly-like sheen of death over the pupil. He straightened up and laid aside his spear. The hunt was over. By custom, he should now sing a prayer of thanks to the forest god for such largesse. He actually uttered the first words of the prayer before he broke off guiltily. He knew that he could never sing the hunter's prayer again, and a profound sadness filled his being. He made a small fire and cut the rich, fatty meat out of the elephant's cheek and cooked it on a skewer over the coals. For once this choice morsel was tough and tasteless in his mouth. He spat it into the fire and sat for a long time beside the carcass before he could rouse himself and shrug off the sense of sorrow that weighed him down. He drew his machete from its sheath and began to chop one of the thick yellow tusks from its bony canal in the elephant's skull. The steel rang on the skull and the bone chips flew and fell about his feet as he worked. That was how the men of his clan found him. They were drawn to Piri by the sound of his machete hacking through bone. They came out of the forest silently, led by Sepu and Pamba, and they formed a circle around Piri and the elephant. He looked up and saw them, and he let the machete fall to his side, and he stood with blood on his hands, not daring to meet their eyes. "I will share the reward with you, my brothers," he whispered. But nobody answered him. One at a time, the bambuti turned from him and disappeared back into the forest as silently as they had come, until only Sepu remained.
"Because of what you have done, the forest god will send the mulimo to us," said Sepu.
And Piri stood with despair in his heart and could not raise his head to meet his brother's eyes. Daniel began to review the videotapes as soon as they reached Gondala. Kelly set aside a corner of her laboratory for him to work in, and Victor Omeru hovered over him, making comments and suggestions as he compiled his editing notes. The quality of the material he had gathered was good. As a cameraman, he rated himself as competent, but lacking the artistry and brilliance of somebody like Bonnie Mahoon. What he compiled was an honest, sober record of the mining and logging operation in the Wengu Forest Reserve, and some of the consequences. "It's got no human warmth to it," he told Victor and Kelly at dinner that evening. "It appeals to reason, not to the heart. I need something more."
"What is it you want?" Kelly asked.
"Tell me what it is and I'll get it for you."
"I want more of President Omeru," Daniel said. "You have presence and style, sir. I want much more of you."
"You shall have me," Victor Omeru nodded. "But don't you think it's time we dispensed with the formalities, Daniel? After all, we have climbed the sacred honey tree together. Surely that entitled us to use each other's Christian names."
"I'm sure it does, Victor," Daniel agreed. "But even you won't be enough to convince the world. I have to show them what's happening to human beings. I have to show them the camps where the Yuhali forced labor units are housed. Can you arrange that?"
Victor leaned forward.
"Yes," he said. "You know that I am the leader of the resistance movement to Tafari's tyranny. We are growing stronger every day. At present it is all very much underground, but we are organizing ourselves and recruiting all the most important and influential people who reject Tafari. Of course we are mostly Uhali, but even some of Tafari's own Haita people are becoming disenchanted with his regime. We will be able to get you to see the labor camps. Of course, you won't be able to get into the camps, but we should be able to get you close enough to film some of the daily atrocities which are being perpetrated. Yes, Kelly asserted. Patrick and the other young resistance leaders will be arriving here within the next few days for a conference with Victor. He will be able to arrange it. She broke off and thought for a moment. Then there are the Bambuti. You can show your audience how the destruction of the forest will affect the Pygmies and destroy their traditional way of life.
That's exactly the type of material I still need, Daniel replied. What do you suggest?
The Malemo ceremony, Kelly said.
Sipu tells me that the Malemo is coming, and he has agreed that you may witness it.
Patrick, Victor Umeru's nephew, arrived at Gondala a day earlier than was expected. He was accompanied by a retinue of a dozen or so Uhali tribesmen. The Pygmies had guided them through the forest. Many of the delegation were also relatives of Victor Umeru, all of them educated and committed young men. When Daniel showed them the tapes he had already filmed and described the material he still required, Patrick Umeru and his men were enthusiastic.
"Leave it to me, Dr. Armstrong," Patrick told him. "I will arrange it for you. Of course, there will be some danger involved. The camps are well protected by the Haita, but we'll get you as close as is humanly possible."
When Patrick and his men left Gondola, Daniel and Sipu went with them. The two of them returned to Gondala 9 days later. Daniel was thin and gaunt. It was obvious that they had travelled hard and unremittingly. His clothing was mud-stained and tattered, and Kelly saw at once that he was near the point of exhaustion as he stumbled up on the veranda of the bungalow. Without thinking, she ran to greet him, and the next moment they were in each other's arms. It startled both of them. They clung to each other for a moment, but when Daniel turned his mouth down towards hers, Kelly broke away and shook his hand instead.
"Victor and I were so worried," she blurted. But she was blushing a deep rose colour that Daniel found enchanting, and she released his hand quickly.
That afternoon, after Daniel had bathed and eaten and slept for 2 hours, he showed them the new material. There were sequences of the forced labour gangs working along the logging roads. They had obviously been filmed from a distance with a telephoto lens. The Haita guards stood over the gangs with clubs in their hands, and they struck out seemingly at random at the half-naked men and women toiling in the mud and slush below them.
"I've got much too much of this," Daniel explained, "but I'll edit it down and keep only the most striking sequences."
There were sequences of the gangs being marched in slow, exhausted columns back to the camps at the end of the day's work, and other shots taken through wire of their primitive living conditions. Then there were a series of interviews shot in the forest with prisoners who had escaped from the camps. One of the men stripped naked in front of the camera and displayed the injuries that the guards had inflicted upon him. His back was cut to ribbons by the lash, and his skull was crisscrossed with scars and half-healed cuts where the clubs had fallen. A young woman showed her feet. The flesh was rotting and falling away from the bone. She spoke in soft Swahili, describing the conditions in the camp.
"We work all day in the mud. Our feet are never dry. The cuts and scratches on them fester like this until we cannot walk. We cannot work."
She began to weep softly. Daniel was sitting beside her on the log. He looked up at the camera, which he had previously set up on a tripod.
"This is what the soldiers in the trenches of France during World War I called trench foot. It's a contagious fungoidal infection that will cripple the sufferer, will literally rot his feet off if it is not treated."
Daniel turned back to the weeping woman and asked gently in Swahili,
"What happens when you can no longer work?" "The Haitas say they will not feed us, that we eat too much food and are no longer of any use. They take the sick people into the forest."
Daniel switched off the VTR and turned to Kelly and Victor.
"What you are about to see are the most shocking sequences I have ever filmed. They're similar to the scenes of the Nazi death squads in Poland and Russia. Some of the quality might be rather poor. We were filming from hiding. It's horrible stuff. You might prefer not to watch it, Kelly?"
Kelly shook her head.
"I'll watch it," she said firmly.
"Okay, but I warned you." Daniel switched on the VTR, and they leaned forwards towards the tiny screen as it flickered and came alive again. They were looking into a clearing in the forest. One of the UDC bulldozers was gouging a trench in the soft earth. The trench was 40 or 50 yards long and at least 10 feet deep, judging by the way the bulldozer almost disappeared into it. Patrick was able to find out from his spies where they were doing this, Daniel explained, so we could get into position the night before. The bulldozer completed the excavation and trundled up out of the trench. It parked nearby. The shot was cut off. The next sequence about 3 hours later, Daniel told them. The head of a column of prisoners appeared out of the forest, chivied on by the Hyter guards on the flanks. It was apparent that all the prisoners were sick or crippled. They staggered or limped slowly into sight. Some were supporting each other with arms around the shoulders. Others were using crude crutches. A few were carried on litters by their companions. One or two of the women had infants strapped on their backs. The guards marched them down into the trench and they disappeared from sight. The guards formed up in a line on top of the excavation. There were at least 50 of them in paratrooper overalls with submachine guns carried on the hip. Quite casually, they began firing down into the trench. The fusillade went on for a long time. As each paratrooper emptied his Uzi machine gun, he reloaded it with a fresh magazine and recommenced firing. Some of the men were laughing. Suddenly, one of the prisoners crawled up over the bank of the pit. It was almost unthinkable that he could have survived this long. One of his legs was half shot away. He dragged himself along on his elbows. A Hyter officer unholstered his pistol and stood over him and shot him in the back of his head. The man collapsed on his face, and the officer put his boot against his ribs and shoved him over the lip of the trench. One at a time, the soldiers stopped shooting. Some of them lit cigarettes and stood in groups along the edge of the grave, smoking and laughing and chatting. The driver of the bulldozer climbed back onto his machine and eased it forward. He lowered the blade and pushed the piles of loose earth back into the trench. When the excavation was refilled, he drove the bulldozer back and forth over it to compact the earth. The soldiers formed up into a column and marched away along the track that they had come. They were out of step and slovenly, chatting and smoking as they went. Daniel switched off the VTR and the screen went blank. Kelly stood up without a word and went out onto the veranda of the bungalow. The two men sat in silence until Victor Umeru said quietly, "Help us, please, Daniel. Help my poor people."